It's time to hit the brakes. Welcome to Swerve South.
Hey, y'all. Welcome to another edition of Swerve South. I'm Jamie Harker. I'm the director of the Sarah Isom Center for Women and Gender Studies at the University of Mississippi. Today, we have a very special edition of Swerve South. It's part of a larger conversation about gender, race, power, and podcasting. I am featuring two podcasters who came to the University of Mississippi on September 19th. The first, Karen Tongson, is an associate professor of English, Gender and Sexuality Studies, and American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California. She's the author of many books, most recently, Why Karen Carpenter Matters. The second participant is Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh, who is an integrated marketing and content strategist in Los Angeles and the owner and principal of Pablo Jobs. Both Karen and Winter have a new podcast called Waiting to Exhale, which is a terrific discussion of Gen X popular culture, and I recommend it highly. They came to the University of Mississippi and recorded a live show in front of an audience with the writer Kiese Lehman, most recently the author of the memoir Heavy, and with the writer and photographer Alicia Steele, who's best known for her work Delta Jewels. While they were here, we had a panel discussion called Tea Time, in which we discussed not only their new venture, but their previous work on the very popular podcast Pop Rocket. I wanted to ask them what happened at the demise of Pop Rocket. And in that conversation, we got some very interesting backstory about the role of cultural brokers and mediators and how gender and race involve those conversations. So you'll step in the middle of that conversation when I ask Karen and Winter about Pop Rocket. So I wanted to do a little background on Pop Rocket for those who may not be as adept in podcasting or pop culture world. Could you talk, and I guess we should start with you, Winter, about how this show formed and some of the ways that it framed itself. And just I'd love to hear about your experiences shaping or thinking about Pop Rocket.
Well, the approach for me that came to Pop Rocket is that Guy Branum, who is ostensibly the host of the show, he was looking for somebody to be like obsessed, super into pop culture, and he was he had gotten my name from Morgan Webb, who is one of my former colleagues from Tech TV, and he worked at Tech TV became, God, what did it become? That sad little gamer network that it tried to be, something TV. He, you know, worked there with Morgan, and when she was on X Play, which is one of the shows that she created while at Tech TV, and she was like, "Oh, Winter knows everything about pop culture," and she was right. And he emailed me and was like, "Hey, do you want to come in and audition?" So I auditioned with them, and there was somebody else that auditioned, and it was like between me and her, and everybody just decided that the dynamic for me was better. And I was definitely like the youngest person in the room, not that youth means anything, but I definitely felt the most inexperienced when it came to like the background of everybody. Like everybody sort of had like a little, like had more writing credits, TV credits, you know, had been, you know, Oliver's like a DJ. Like there was definitely this sort of like, where is she coming from? And, you know, this plays into a lot of what we'll talk about when we talk about the demise. It ended up being one of the situations where I literally spent the entire run of the show trying to not Debbie Matenopoulos myself. Because immediately, you know, amongst all these people, when it came time, you know, when I would look at the reviews on the iTunes reviews, they were always unanimously like negative towards me. And in the beginning, I took it really hard and I felt like, you know, these people are being rude and maybe I shouldn't do this and maybe I don't need this. And then I got extreme trolled at the end of the year. And then that's when I was like, nope, this is my safe haven. I extreme trolled, but this is a separate incident.
This is in the first year?
This is in the first year because remember I went to go work at Reddit. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about that later. I did sign an NDA. so you know, as much as I can talk about it. But yeah, I experienced extreme trolling at that point. And then I said, no, I have to be in a place where it's my safe haven. And that's what Pop Rocket became. It's everything that we talked about were the things that I enjoyed. And it was a great place to be creative and not have to worry about work, which was always so in flux for me. And sort of like, this was like a consistent, because work, you know, I have a client for 8-9 months, a year, whatever. And then I move on to another batch of people, or I do this and that. And it's just always was something going on, you know, professionally for me, good and bad. And then like, you know, getting married and all that stuff like that. But there was like a consistent, you know, space and honor that I held for Pop Rocket. Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the things, too, that Winter didn't mention as part of that narrative, though, is that if in the beginning people were harsh in the iTunes reviews or whatever, by the time like the show was in full bloom, Winter was among the most popular figures and definitely people who the listeners felt most connected to, I think, in various ways, because you were very... no holds barred, and you expressed your emotions and your feelings and
I've cried many a time,
honestly and sincerely on the show. And I think that was a really important thing that was part of the, not only like you, but the dynamic that we shared together.
And so, I think for Karen, just to that end, like, I think Karen was the most solid and grounding force for the entire show.
I'm a Virgo. So.
She's a Virgo. So she was able to sort of give it that, like, I know like there were many times where she was thrown into situations where she would have to host at the last minute. And it was, she could rise to the occasion like no other. So I think that is, you know, her being an addition to the show in that sense, she definitely brought so much to the table.
Very organized. I would
yeah, she was definitely
the
organized.
The bullet pointed, bolded list of things. Yeah. So I was like, maybe we should do these things, point, 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 which nobody ever reads. So it's all good.
So you mentioned the audience, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that before we jump into the demise, because one of the things I noticed was what an engaged fan base and what a wide-ranging fan base was. After I did the drop-in on Pop Rocket, I had people talking to me from all over the country to say, I heard you on Pop Rocket. That's so awesome. Like, there's a 70-year-old retired woman in Water Valley who listened to it. There was, like, a woman who was, like, in Salt Lake City who loved it. I mean, I had people, academics were texting me, and I thought, whoa, I had no idea. I just stepped into, like, Hollywood glamour.
I love
like
hearing that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's like, so I remember the very first time someone, like, I went to a restaurant in L.A., and, you know, and the person was like, are you Karen Thompson? And I thought, this must be a former student of mine. And she's like, I'm a big Pop Rocket fan. And I was like, what? Like, you could recognize my voice? Because I don't think that, you know, like, or you went through the trouble to Google what I look like.
Yeah.
You know, like, because yeah, that's, and once, actually towards the end of the run of Pop Rocket, I was in the Bay Area. I was in Berkeley. And I was just walking down the street talking to my wife, and this person stops me. And it looked like they had been working out, you know, and they're like running. They take their earbuds out and they're like, it's so weird. I'm listening to you right now and you're right here in front of me. And I was just consistently shocked.
It always, literally all the time. Or when I'm
no
in
idea.
Different, when I'm in other podcasts, Facebook groups, who was I just talking to this about this earlier? Kristen, like other people will be like, you know, we'll be talking about something completely like off topic, and they'll be like, oh God, Winter, I miss Pop Rocket. I just want to tell you that I'm a big fan. And it's like always like, oh shit, I'm gonna watch what I'm saying up in here. And that's the first thing I think of. And then I go, oh shucks, that was nice.
Yeah.
So I just have to give you credit for this, that I was telling you this story earlier. After my drop-in, Violet Valley Bookstore was name-dropped in Oprah Magazine as one of the best independent bookstores in the state of Mississippi, leapfrogging Square Books, which I'm sure was horrifying to all those who've been running it. And everyone said, how did that happen? I'm like, I'm convinced it's Pop Rocket, because this didn't happen before.
Hashtag flex.
Right? You know, I mean, I can't take credit for it, but I'm glad that I got a drop-in, because that gave me all kind of street cred I didn't have before and don't deserve. So let's get into it. So not long after my drop-in, there was a sudden announcement that Max Fun, who was the sponsor of Pop Rocket, was canceling the show.
Yeah.
And I want to let you all narrate how you found out about it and what seemed to happen and then what some of the backlash was.
Wow. I mean, I don't know like where to begin with this. I think that it happened very quickly. As you said, like I think it was within a couple of weeks after Jamie showed up and we were discussing how Violet Valley was nominated for this award we gave called the Pop Rocket Seal of Approval. And you know, we'd had, look, we're all busy people, all the people who were on Pop Racket. We're not primarily podcasters, so that's not our primary gig. All four of us, we have real full-time jobs and other things that we're beholden to. So you can imagine that scheduling four people gets difficult over a period of time. And so there were some issues that were kind of arising around that, and different people had different things. But, you know, we kept going strong, and the fan base never wavered, really, and it was very devoted and loyal. And at some point, because Guy, our host, had been tapped to do another show, to work on something important, he was going to. He said, "Look, I would like to scale back and not. I can't do this every week anymore. Maybe I could come in occasionally and be a kind of pop in as a kind of guest host, or like make his commitment less regular." And a similar vibe came from Margaret. I think all of us, you know, squeezing this in once a week every time
is
really difficult. So, I mean, so people wanted to kind of, you know, a couple folks from the panel wanted to maybe move on. And that had happened before when Oliver departed and I kind of stepped in. So, you know, we sort of found these things out kind of quickly. And Winter and I decided, as people who wanted to continue and who still had the bandwidth to continue, that we were very much looking forward to getting to talk to Max Fun about what next steps would be, different ways of retooling the show, of rethinking the way it had been organized, because we'd been wanting to anyway kind of, I don't know, change the format a little bit and maybe appeal to like a broader or different listenerships. But we basically didn't.
She's being really diplomatic.
Well, you know, like, so
Max
Fun
basically played us. They had been playing us for a long time.
Yeah.
They had, you know, I think they think they're very much like Joe Jackson. Like, it doesn't matter if I beat you every day. You've sold 200 million records. It was essentially like, we pay for this show, we pay you, you have a producer, you know, but so you should be appreciative and you should be happy to have this, but you're ungrateful brats and we no longer really have the patience for you. That is basically the tone I got from them. That's the way I felt. I felt like we wanted to develop the show into different spaces to keep up and catch up with other. I mean, look, at the end of the day, you have to develop and retool.
And grow.
And grow. Like, you need to grow. But I think that the biggest issue for me, I'm speaking for myself. I'm not speaking for the rest of the panel. I think they can all speak for themselves. Everybody has a Twitter account. I think that I'm speaking for myself. You know, Jesse, who owns Max Fun, didn't sow the seeds of growth that we needed, and the entire company failed us in that sense. I think one of the biggest things that you're trying to do when you're trying to compete in this marketplace, there's all these other networks popping up. There's all this migration happening. You know, now they're starting to say celebrities created podcasting when people have been doing this for years. And we had to find a space to sort of grow. We saw we had SNL, people from SNL on our, that became SNL
cast
members.
They weren't on SNL before, but
we had people that are now like, you know, names. And we never had a process or they were never held to a standard like, you need to promote that you were on the show or retweet or anything like that. And as it started becoming like understandable that that is the way marketing is going, I found myself constantly pushing. It's not something that I can also just do. I was, by virtue of being myself on Twitter, I'm promoting the show. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And it just became a situation where it was really uncomfortable for me in particular, because, you know, Jesse had made a point of saying in the very beginning that I was the least, you know, known worthy of being on this panel. And that carried with me to the very end when the last time I saw him, because it, to me, it's this sense of, again, this white male authority sort of dictating my worth and acting like you should be lucky to be here. And the fact of the matter is that wasn't even my first podcast. I'd been on other podcasts. I'd been doing things. I've been writing since I was 16 years old. My first byline was when I was 16. Like, I'm not doing it on the level that the other three were, but I'm also still out there making shit happen. I'm known more than he was. And introducing all of these people at Max Fun to other people to help their cause. There was no, like, helping of the cause of Pop Rocket. And the resentment that I have, maybe it's not healthy, but I will have forever, because we could have done something so great, because we were doing something so great.
Well, we did
great.
Yeah, we were doing something so great. I think that the way I see it was that we actually, and the thing that I think was most hurtful to me, especially as the end was announced to us unceremoniously right before we were to record an episode, which was really bad timing, honestly, to do
it's
that.
It's not bad timing. Again, it was the disrespect and the disregard.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. And I think that, like, you and I had actually taken the time. We were ready to make a pitch for what to do next. And I mean, we were never given really hard numbers. That was another sort of thing that I've tweeted about consistently, so it's not a new thing to say here, that everybody was like, well, the show was failing or it was losing listeners or whatever. It really wasn't.
It wasn't.
And also, we never got a status update we only got our listener numbers when we begged to see them.
And the other thing, too, is this is something that
so
other people...
So it wasn't like a regular report monthly or that
other
kind of
people
thing.
Had said mentioned this, too. They talked about this. Other shows that had left Max Fun talked about, you know, Jonathan Van Ness just said the same thing. I mean, it's the same.
The show was canceled too.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the thing is, so basically we put the effort in, and we were ready to do this, and we were ready to tackle the difficult task of, I think, of maybe remaking the show and of doing something big with it and trying to implement the things that we had been talking about and trying to encourage the network to do. For like the last
and
couple
years.
And
they just were not down or interested.
And then, we didn't even get a chance to say anything, and we were just told we were canceled. And that was
so,
that.
Yeah, that's basically what happened. It was whack.
Could I jump in? Because when you talked about the leadership, that raised a question I wanted to ask you. Mm-hmm. When the two white co-hosts decided to move on to other projects, they did not trust the two of you to reinvent it.
Mm-mm.
And that raises this question of who the media gatekeepers are and who is making decisions about what's saleable or what commodities are valuable. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that barrier, especially for women of color and folks who don't look like the ones in charge of capital who are making decisions.
You know, I don't even know that it was a conscious decision, but it is the political unconscious of podcastery that it's just, you know, to assume that, I mean, we wouldn't have the capacity to draw people or listeners or to sustain interest in a particular way. I mean, I think that just beyond our particular case, if you look across the board at who runs the podcasting world, it is often white men, and of who gets to have shows successful, unsuccessful, what have you, like on and given many chances, it is often like bros, you know? And it's not like particular kinds of dudes just talking and shooting the shit with each other and that kind of thing. And it's just sort of like, and there's a lot of space for that. Now there's like of overcorrection happening. I think, well, not overcorrection, but like a kind of scramble to enlist diverse voices, have, you know, like, in a kind of mad dash for these things, everybody's trying to cultivate that. That's at least word on the street. But in the end, I think what's going to be made and made possible in this particular scenario, it's in part because of the way that I think the creative male is like basically mythologized in the podcasting world. It's like, oh, just a dude in his garage, you know, decided to talk and was awesome and like, and that, you know, that's just so democratic and amazing. And that went down. And then so, like, there's so much mythos around that. Or, like, you know, this person created that company, and he's just, like, he struck out on his own. He struck out on his own. And these sorts of narratives that float around. And everybody else is just, I don't know, maybe talent or, like, you know, not seen as people worthy of producing, that kind of thing.
I mean, I look at Luminary and I feel like I look at all their ads, I look at all the promotion, and I don't hear anybody talking about any of the podcasts that are on that network. I hear them talking about underground stuff. I hear them talking about stuff that is, you know, self-produced. I also feel like, look, no offense, some of my clients have podcasts on, you know,
various networks,
but it feels like an infringement on space. It feels like this is a very individualized process, and, you know, unique voices are what makes podcasting thrive. And I think that it's being used by certain influencers as an extension of their brand. And then I'll listen to their podcasts I'm not naming anybody in particular, but it's like, I already get that from you when you're a show, when you're on stage, whatever. Like, I already get that from you. It's much more interesting when they're guests and not controlling the conversation and allowing themselves to sort of be fed through whatever format is developed by that podcast. And I think those are more interesting conversations than me just being like, I'm rich and I'm famous and here's my podcast. Like, you know, the fact that Conan O'Brien, whom I love and think is great, but his narcissism is out of control, in particular because his show is like called Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend. And it just so happens all his friends are rich, famous white people. And it's like, I just feel like that's, you know, and he's one of the most successful at it. And it's just, again, it's just like the consistent like recycling of those things. And I'm not saying that I'm like the best podcast voice out there, but I'm speaking for an audience that I love. I'm trying to be their friend. I'm trying to let them know that they're black people are not monolith, that they're you also have a black friend, and your black friend loves Metallica, but your black friend is also militant as F and really doesn't care about this administration, but at the same time Hustlers was amazing. Like, I want you to feel like you're having a conversation with us. And I think that I do that really well. I think that I'm honest, and I think that I'm consistent, and I think that we need to have more of those voices across the board, and we need to have more dynamic voices working together. That's how I feel about Karen. We don't agree on the same thing. We don't have the same cadence. She's way more organized than I am. You know, high energy in other ways. I'm high energy in other ways, but I think that I'm more interested in that scenario than I am of hearing Joe Rogan for 3.5 hours talk about is there aliens or not.
Well, you know, one of the I have to say
for 3 hours.
Well, yeah, I know. Well, or even just like, you know, with the whole Shane Gillis thing that just broke, and where, you know, he was hired on SNL then fired from SNL, and you know, you see like the clip, just the clip from the podcast itself, I'm just like, that's just like two dudes talking shit, like, and racist shit, like, and you know, and none of it is funny or amusing or engaging or interesting. I really just don't see what like a hack joke from the 50s is, like, makes that amusing or worth recording, not only on audio but like a video file of that as well. I'm like, well, okay. But one of the things, you know, a lot of women listen to podcasts too. That's the thing. It's just like, I think that there's a growing an expansive listenership of women. And this is one of the things that became apparent to us when we actually just looked into ourselves, just dug into and realized who the most fervent Pop Rocket listeners and fans were. In fact, Waiting to Exhale in many respects is service to those diehards, because we looked, the people who were most engaged were women, Gen X, you know, around that kind of sphere. And we're really responsive to when we would talk about our experiences from that kind of age bracket, and like to kind of talk about or reminisce about some of the pop culture that was important at that time. Those were some of the most, I guess, you know, like most popular episodes that we did at Pop Rocket, like the 1991 episode or whatever, like that received a kind of fervent response. It may not be huge numbers, but it's an engaged
audience.
It's about like engagement and a fervency of engagement than just pure numbers. But the numbers are also kind of, you know, there, and it's been nice to have that support continue on, especially given how little, as I always say, it's not just that we have full-time jobs, we both already have overtime jobs. And so, like, I think, you know, making the space to do this and also getting the chance to, like, share the work in settings outside of just the two of us showing up at a studio, like coming here, that's been really important. It's a real shot in the arm as we squeeze it into our really, really narrow schedules.
Mm-hmm. I want to have you talk about this new venture. But before we do, I just want the audience to sort of note what a fervent fan base you have. And one of the things I noticed was the response, the revolt, basically, on the Facebook page, on Twitter. There was a moment, I think, Winter, when you stole back the Facebook page from Max Fun because they were threatening to close it because of all the negative responses, and there was a kind of takeover.
Well, they didn't want us to, like, have control over the Facebook page.
They didn't want us to have control over all the social.
Yeah.
And I was able to – Margaret was asleep at the wheel. She'll admit to it for the Twitter. But Facebook, I grabbed that shit back so fast, and I took it over, and I can't think of a pop culture reference at this time about it, but it reminded me of something when I took it over, and then I just went, and then somebody from Max Fun, I won't name, is like, can you please just at least, and I was like, no, like that was my response back.
Well, it's also a following that we built, and like, you know, the
we built it,
and
they
then we cultivated by
nothing.
Engaging the audience, right? So we, it's not like the network ever did anything for us on that page. We just kept growing the listenership, and we would go and participate in these discussions or talk about, you know, the latest whatever film and pipe in on whether or not it was worth watching this particular season of Stranger Things or whatever. And so we did that. We took our time to do that and to talk to people.
And it seems like it's nothing. It seems like it's not a big deal, but it is a big deal to stay engaged and create an engaged audience. Like everything, there are people right now on Instagram that have like 10 million followers. And people think, oh, that person has 10 million followers. Yeah, that person probably gets like 6,000, 7,000, 100,000 likes. In what world is it that it's good for you to have 10 million people who are on an app that everybody knows they're on all the time, and only 100,000 of those people look at your stuff? That's terrible. But you can also have 100,000 people following you and get 50,000 likes, and that's an engaged audience. At least half of everybody that went by this post saw it. And that, to me, is what I felt like we had when it came to that Facebook page. The reason why I was so aggressive about it is because, you know, I wanted the Twitter, but the Twitter was never served to its purpose. The Facebook is where people talked about their kids. They talked about their home life. They talked about their divorce, writing their dissertations. They talked about their lives in the context of this show of topics that we curated. And that's exactly why I was like, you know what? Keep all the rest of that crap. We're at least, at the very least, going to continue to give these people a place to have a conversation where they feel safe. Mm-hmm. And that, more than anything, post-Trump, is exactly what people are gravitating towards. Facebook groups are booming. Reddit communities are booming because people want a safe space to have a conversation without fear of judgment, left or right. And that is exactly why I wanted to make sure that if anything else, I was going to boot them off of admin, which I did, which they would have never have known how to do. And it just so happens that I did it really fast. They wouldn't even, their head spun.
You had that handled.
This is such a labor conversation in some ways, you know, like who owns the beans of production, and are you just, you know, workers, or are you actually owners? And I think that's very much part of this, that the way that sort of big capital is now taking over what had been a much more democratic space. Thanks again to Winter and Karen for a very interesting conversation about culture, politics, and podcasting. They have, as I mentioned before, a terrific new podcast called Waiting to Exhale, which is available on a number of platforms, including iTunes. To hear more of Waiting to Exhale, please subscribe to their podcast. To hear the complete conversation, they make that available to Patreon supporters of Waiting to Exhale. Thanks again, and I'll see you next time on Swerve South.
Swerve South is a production of the Sarah Isom Center for Women and Gender Studies, with support from the Southern Documentary Project, music and engineering by Tyler Keith.